Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of the Street Cop Podcast. With me for the legal portion of this podcast is Zach Miller. He's one of our instructors, teaches constitutional policing, a great course. If you ever get a chance to take it, it is an honor to sit in his presence and listen to him speak and give some real thorough explanations on the Supreme Court of the United States rulings, Fourth Amendment search and seizure, case law, that whole nine, everything that we need to know as police officers. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Dennis. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, brother. Glad that we get to do this on Zoom. It's going to be sad if we don't get to do this on a Zoom one day. We have to do it without the video portion of it.
We'll make do.
Wait, what, you know what we'll do? We'll try to supplement that maybe with like a FaceTime or like a Messenger video chat.
There you go.
You don't seem too thrilled. All right. So this week's topic is a hot topic nationally. And it's funny, we've discussed this before, you and I, and it's qualified immunity. Let's go right into it. Zach, I'll let you, you know, you're the guy on it. I'm here to listen. I have a feel of the subject, but you're certainly going to know a lot more about it than I do. So go ahead.
Okay. So qualified immunity is a big hot topic nationwide. For several reasons, and it's widely misunderstood by everybody, officers, politicians, interest groups, what it really is and what it does. So I'm gonna try to break it down as simple as possible. I've asked numerous officers over the last several months, you know, you tell me what quality, you know, they're up in arms about it. And, I'm like, well, it's without getting emotional, can you try and explain to me what qualified immunity is? And I have yet to have a single officer adequately describe what it is. So it's essentially a defense in a civil suit. It operates like a defense, and it is the product of a federal statute. So the statute we're all familiar with is the Federal Civil Rights Violation Statute, 1983. It's a statute that gives a victim or a plaintiff in a civil rights deprivation case the authority to sue a police officer. It establishes essentially a constitutional tort. So if an officer violates someone's constitutional rights, and for us, that's normally going to be the Fourth Amendment that we're talking about. The 1983 authorizes a lawsuit, a federal suit against the officer. And so it's a statute created by Congress. In the early 60s, the U.S. Supreme Court, for the first time, held that there is a built-in defense called qualified immunity to a civil suit available to police officers or any government official. And it was greatly expanded in the 80s to become what it is today. So essentially what qualified immunity is, any tort, anything you're sued for, there are defenses available to it. Qualified immunity is one available for the constitutional tort. And what it says is that if an officer doesn't violate clearly established law, or the allegation against the officer hasn't been previously established clearly by the courts, then the officer can claim defense from liability. So if he's being sued, for example, in excessive force, a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and the facts of his case weren't clearly established before the offense that could be a violation of the Fourth Amendment, the officer is entitled to what's called qualified immunity. Since over the years, the Supreme Court has greatly expanded what qualified immunity covers, and it covers clearly unconstitutional conduct. Like, an officer can clearly violate someone's constitutional rights. But essentially, if he was the first officer to do that, he's awarded qualified immunity. Now, moving forward, any officer that does the exact same thing or something very similar to that officer would not be entitled to the defense of qualified immunity. But what it does, it deprives the plaintiff of even getting into a jury to have a jury hear the case. And that's the controversial aspect of it. That and the fact that the Supreme Court essentially invented the defense in one of its cases. It's not written in the statute. Nowhere in the language of the statute does it even suggest there's a defense of qualified immunity. The Supreme Court said basically the common law would allow this type of a defense. And there's a couple other reasons the Supreme Court has given over the years why it exists. It's very controversial. Up until the last several years, it had been mainly in academic circles that it had been debated whether it was lawful or not. And now, of course, it's gotten a lot of attention.
Yeah, because police have been made now to be it's topsy-turvy world. For some odd reason, the best people we have in society are now being, well, okay, we know the reason, right? But are now being pointed out to say that they're the criminals. And the reason comes down to is media. It makes money. It's great.
It's a hot button political issue. And folks on both sides of the spectrum, right and left, have issues with qualified immunity. I mean, if you want my honest opinion, I don't think qualified immunity should exist either. Under the language of the statute, I think the Supreme Court's justification for having qualified immunity is shaky at best, but it's there. So one of the things that's being proposed is, so there's two ways that qualified immunity can be gotten rid of under 1983. Either the Supreme Court can overrule itself and limit qualified immunity or do away with it completely. That's not likely to happen. Or Congress can pass a statute or amend the 1983 statute and say qualified immunity is not an available offense. So only Congress or the U.S. Supreme Court can affect federal qualified immunity.
Would you have, if you were a state officer and they removed qualified immunity through their state constitution, would you still be covered under the federal constitution for qualified immunity if it went to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes. So, well, this is what states are doing. So several states, and Virginia was one of them last year, it didn't pass, but several states, I know Colorado, what was the recent one? Was it Connecticut or Massachusetts? One another state recently effectively abolished qualified immunity. Well, what they're doing is they're creating a state version of Section 1983. And it mirrors the language of 1983, except in the state statute, it says, and by the way, qualified immunity is not available defense. So that's how they're getting around the federal standard, because a state cannot abolish the federal qualified immunity.
Right.
They can only the Supreme Court or Congress. So now a plaintiff in Colorado, for example, who's had his equivalent of their Fourth Amendment rights violated under the Colorado Constitution could sue in Colorado state court for basically the same conduct and the same remedy that if he had sued under federal court. So they're not, and to say that qualified immunity is being abolished is misleading, because only Congress or the United States Supreme Court can do that. But states can clearly work around it by virtue of state law. So most states, this is the, I guess, the key takeaway of this conversation that I wanted to talk to, is this concept of indemnification. Virtually most states have either a statute or some kind of protection in their police officer bill of rights or their version of their law enforcement officer bill of rights that deals with indemnification, that essentially requires agencies to cover damages awarded against an employee in a civil suit. Which basically means that if I got sued as an individual police officer for my conduct on the job, and I was found to be liable, so went all the way to the jury, and the jury awarded the plaintiff, the person suing me, $10,000 for whatever violation I committed. Under the principle of indemnification, my agency pays that judgment, the full judgment, including the attorney's fees. It's called indemnification. A lot of states have statutes that say that, but virtually all agencies or municipalities have policies that deal with it. There was a study done a few years ago over a five-year period by a law professor out in California that found over almost 10,000 civil rights cases. So over a five-year period, almost 10,000 civil rights cases against police officers. Officers were found to have contributed 0.41% of the time to judgments. That's less than half of 1% of the time officers were required to pay a portion of the judgment, for a total value nationwide in 5 years of $170,000. So of all successful lawsuits against police officers of this five-year period, and this was in the mid-20-teens, officers were responsible for $170,000 total.
Against 10,000 of them.
Against 10,000 suits in which tens of millions of dollars were awarded to the
plaintiff. So personally, they were responsible for
$170,000 amongst all of them added up together. Most of those were punitive damages, meaning the officer was so outrageous in his conduct that they were awarded what are called punitive damages. And a lot of times agencies do cover punitive damages, but a lot of times they don't. Normally in a civil suit, you get what are called compensatory damages. Punitive damages are reserved for those suits where the conduct was so outrageous, so egregious, that it bordered on the line of criminality. So less than 0.5% of the time, officers were responsible for a portion of the judgment. And that's not going to change with, you know, that's with qualified immunity where it is right now. And that's not going to change. You know, it's not good for business for an agency to develop a reputation of not paying judgments against its own officers in a civil suit for doing what they are trained to do. You will not lose your house. You know, I hear that all the time. You know, I'll lose my house, I'll lose my pension. It doesn't work that way. Our civil system doesn't work that way. If you're acting under the color of your authority, then 99 and more than 99.5% of the time, any judgment that is awarded against you, that's not even counting all the times these cases are tossed out early, less than 0.5% of the time, you may have to pay a portion of that judgment. And I would bet that that's more normally when your conduct is so far afield of the norm that it's probably warranted.
So in a nutshell, Zach, what you're saying is the loss of qualified immunity as a political ploy is one thing, as a media play is another, but in all reality means absolutely nothing.
It really means nothing to the individual officer. It could cause insurance rates for agencies to go up in some jurisdictions that are prone to lawsuits, but it is it's a way for a politician to say that, you know, we scored points, we abolished qualified immunity. Really, functionally, that doesn't do anything. It doesn't change the standard as to what is a violation of the Constitution or not. Just the lack of qualified immunity, all that does is it allows more cases to make it to a jury. And so this is where you need to understand another part of how civil lawsuits operate. There's an early stage, a pretrial stage, which is called summary judgment, where the defense, which would be our side, would motion for the judge to dismiss the suit. So once all the discovery has been made, all the evidence has been collected, we're going to allege that even if this went to the jury, no reasonable jury could find that we violated this person's constitutional rights. And if that is true, if a judge looks at that and says, yeah, there's no reason to even take this to a jury because there's no facts that would support this claim, we would be awarded what's called summary judgment. And that exists whether qualified immunity is there or not. That exists in any civil lawsuit. This is how frivolous lawsuits are disposed of. It's how lawsuits that really don't, that lack any merit are kept from the trial stage. And as just a matter of fact, if an agency, of course, your agency is going to be sued too. Anytime you're sued as an individual, your agency is going to be sued as well, because they're the ones that have the deep suit. Civil suits are about money. That's all they're about. And your agency has way more money than you do. So they're going to be named as well. If we lose at the summary judgment stage, where the judge says, no, there's enough of a case to at least let the jury hear this, that's all that losing summary judgment means. Most of the time, agencies will settle the lawsuit at that point because it's cheaper to pay the plaintiff something than to continue on to trial and pay a bunch of attorneys. And we could potentially be on the hook for attorney's fees if we lose. So most cases are settled if we lose summary judgment. And a lot of times a condition and a settlement agreement is, if you dismiss the individual officer, we will settle with you for X dollars, X number of dollars is what a municipal attorney will frequently do. So there's lots of ways officers are not going to be, they don't need to be concerned. They really don't. I mean, it's a political push. Personally, I'm not worried about it. If you're that worried about losing qualified immunity, my contention would be, are you saying you're so worried about losing qualified immunity because you're out here violating people's constitutional rights on a regular basis that you're going to lose this protection? If you're out following your training, following your policy, anybody can sue anybody. As long as you're acting under within the bounds of your authority, the bounds of your training and policy, you really don't have a lot to worry about.
So, yeah, I figured as much. Just like anything else, the knee jerk reactions. And I want to urge people, if you're listening to this and watching this, whatever it may be, before you have an emotional reaction to a headline that you're reading, here's some good advice. How about you read the fucking thing? Yeah. And we see this over and over again. You'll get the media taking headlines and running ads against them. And, they're selling advertising space. So they're going to make it seem very romantic to the person who they're trying to attract, but they're distorting the truth tremendously. Do you remember that case that came out of Oregon where it was a while ago, maybe 2 years ago, I talked about it in class I don't have it in front of me, but it was about cops. Remember this one? Cops can never ask questions again on traffic stops. And the question I had to everybody was, did you even read the case? Nobody read it. They just hit share from the CNN.com or FoxNews.com. And if you read the case, all they did was follow what the Supreme Court of the United States said. I believe in Rodriguez in Illinois. I think he was extending the stops without reasonable suspicion and going on fishing expeditions, which if you know what you're doing, and it came down to this gentleman probably got away with it plenty of times because he found a way to do it that wasn't malicious. It wasn't intentional. It was the way he thought worked, didn't know anything about case law. And then all of a sudden somebody got an attorney that had a half a brain, which was hard to find. And you know that. Right. I mean, that's truth. I mean, I always tell people in class, what does somebody's law degree tell you? It tells you they know how to take a test and pass it and nothing else. It really doesn't explain much. Zach, for the people who are listening, how many courses are mandatory in law school on Fourth Amendment search and seizure in order to complete your degree, your law degree? How many are you required to take?
There's two that I know we'll at least talk about, your Crim Pro, your criminal procedure class. That's probably the one where you cover it the most. And then constitutional law, you may mention a couple of cases, but that's more about the seven articles of the Constitution. So very little of your law school career are you spent studying the Fourth Amendment.
Would somebody be able to graduate law school with having a real good understanding of constitutional case law and how it's applied?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's just one small part of law school. Absolutely.
You know, I say this because we do have the difficult conversation here of, you know, listen, if we're trying to fix things and you want things to get better, you have to understand where the faults are in our profession. And one of the things I would urge you to do is really begin to self-educate. Don't have such an emotional knee-jerk reaction to things you're seeing in the media. There's a lot. Just please, you know, it's just crazy today, for example. For the timestamp 4/2/21, as we're doing recording this podcast, New York has now legalized marijuana, followed by New Mexico. And the guys from New York are literally sending in messages like crazy, like the whole world is coming to a complete stop. And I just want to remind everybody, if you think you're going to finish your career, now, Zach, you might finish your career before it becomes legalized where you are. But if you think you're going to finish your career before, and you got 15, 20, 25 years left, before the federal government steps in and makes this stuff legal, you're out of your mind because it's going to be legal. It's going to be just like alcohol. Somebody asked me the other day, hey, what do you think is going to happen for police officers to smoke marijuana? Right? This guy in the office asked me that. And I see it's an interesting question because it's so villainized and demonized. However, in contrary to alcohol, which is the less of the two evils, right? Why is alcohol more accepted than marijuana? And listen, I could argue my points and whatever it may be. And he said, when do you think it's going to be settled on whether cops can utilize marijuana substances or everybody can? And I said, when the first person pisses hot and fights it in court. And, you know, you're going to make your way up to a state court where they're going to say, well, hold on. It's a legalized substance. If you're over 21, just like alcohol. So I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I got a funny feeling you're going to be able to use it. I don't know how you feel about that.
I agree. Yeah, I think they can have a hard time justifying off-duty conduct that allow it, you know, making it against policy to use marijuana off-duty. Now, coming to work, you know, high is just like coming to work drunk. Can't do that. But yeah, I don't. Regulating off-duty conduct can be tricky.
What was the deal with like some of the Virginia? I remember like Virginia Beach years ago, like 20 years ago, I was looking at it. They would test you for tobacco use.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, there are agencies that will piss test you for tobacco use, and you can come up with tobacco and piss.
That's probably done for insurance purposes to lower their premiums, because a lot of agencies have no smoking policies on and off duty, and that's for insurance reasons.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's the only reason they do it, to get lower insurance premiums.
Gotcha. All right. I think that pretty much covers it. So everybody can stop panicking like a little baby and, you know, relax. We'll tell you when you need to panic. It's the next order of business today, Zachary.
So speaking of qualified immunity, there was a case that came out from the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago. Qualified immunity was kind of in the background of the case, but it's Torres versus Madrid. And, this is the case where two officers, they shot at a woman who it sounds like they thought she was trying to run them over, but she was fleeing. She was clearly they clearly weren't shooting at her to defend themselves anymore. She was fleeing the scene, and they shot at her in her vehicle, and they hit her at least once. But she continued, she escaped, she drove away, and about an hour or so later, she checked herself into the hospital and ended up getting arrested for the incident. Well, she sued the officers for violating her Fourth Amendment right, claiming that the shooting was unlawful, and she alleged that her Fourth Amendment rights was violated, meaning she was seized unreasonably by shooting, being shot without probable cause or any additional justification. So the issue in this civil suit was, did the officer seize her? Because yes, we shot her, but she got away. And it's actually an interesting little corner of the Fourth Amendment that hasn't been quite fully developed. There's two ways that a person can be seized, or at least before this case. You can either be seized by a show of authority. So if a police officer orders someone to stop and the person does in fact stop, or a whole bunch of police officers surround someone and there's no physical touching of the person, that's a seizure by show of authority. And then the other way a person can be seized is if we use force on that person and that force restrains their movement. So if I grab onto somebody, that's a seizure of the person. If I shoot them and they fall down and I take them into custody, or if you kill them, that's of course the most extreme type of a seizure. But those are all seizures by application of force where the person is restrained as a result of the force. There was a case from the early 90s called, I think it was the early 90s, California versus Hadari D. That was involved a juvenile who fled at the sight of the police. And his argument was that he was seized. Well, they ended up catching him and found drugs on him later on. But his argument was that he was seized unlawfully, meaning he was seized without reasonable suspicion. And the Supreme Court ultimately held that there was no seizure in this case, because although the officers were ordering him to stop by yelling, "Stop, police," they're clearly identified as police officers, he refused and ran away. He wasn't seized until they ended up tackling him later on. And by that point, they watched him throw some drugs down on the side of the road. So they clearly had reasonable suspicion at that point. But his argument was he was seized at the moment they chased him, and they needed reasonable suspicion for that. So the Supreme Court said there was no seizure because he did not submit to their show of authority. Yes, they exerted authority, but he didn't submit. So it was, for all intents and purposes, an attempted seizure. Well, then the question that kind of lingered after that was, well, what if we use physical force on someone and then they flee? Was that a seizure? And that finally came up with Torres versus Madrid. And this is out of the 10th Circuit. I believe it was in New Mexico where this the facts occurred. And the 10th Circuit held that the officers were entitled to qualified immunity because there was no Fourth Amendment violation. The Fourth Amendment was not implicated because she did not stop after being shot. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. and overturned. The 10th Circuit said no, that was in fact a seizure. So the new rule is the addition to the rule is if an officer applies physical force with the intent to restrain the person, that is a seizure. As a, whether or not they're successful in detaining the person or seizing them or stopping the person doesn't matter. The application of that physical force. So when they shot her, when the bullet struck her, she was seized at that brief moment. And the seizure, of course, stops when she flees. So the court, the case was sent back down to the trial court for a determination of whether the case can proceed. The officers are going to win on qualified immunity here. I'm certain because the law wasn't clearly established. You have the 10th Circuit saying it was one thing. Supreme Court says no, it's something else. So the officers would be entitled to qualified immunity. But so a couple things about this case. It's a very small fact. It's going to be very inconsequential moving forward. There's not going to really be any evidence suppression issues. The only time this is going to come up is in context of a civil lawsuit. No, it does not make it easier to sue police officers. I've seen several headlines and articles that say that's what this case says. It's now easier to sue police officers for excessive force. That's really not true, because even if she had lost her Fourth Amendment claim, she could have sued under the 14th Amendment for a substantive due process violation. She could and did sue under state law for assault and battery. So it doesn't make it easier to sue officers. I think probably at the end of the day, the case is of more interest to an academic person than law enforcement. My personal opinion is I think the court was wrong. It was a 5-3 case. I think the dissent, which is actually a longer opinion than the majority opinion this time, actually got it right. I don't think that a seizure occurs when someone isn't physically restrained, but my opinion doesn't matter. The five justices that held it was a seizure. They're the ones that matter. So interesting case, but not something that's going to change anything how we do business.
How do we get you put onto the Supreme Court of the United States?
I got to have the right political connections, I guess.
Yeah.
Stage in my career, my life, I don't know that I'm not on that trajectory.
Yeah. Well, what else do you have for us this week, Zach?
That was really it. I wanted to, calm some fears about qualified immunity. I think it's
qualm would have been okay. It would have been a good word to
do. Either way.
Qualm and calm, same thing.
Officers just need to kind of settle down and realize this is just another political thing going on. It's one of the hot topics. It really doesn't change a lot of things. It doesn't change the law. It doesn't change what we can and can't do. It just changes the civil procedure slightly.
It's crazy. I was in Illinois recently and people had asked me to look through the Illinois Police Reform Act or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I asked some questions during class. I'm like, are you still allowed to do this? Like, yeah. I'm like, look, I'm not saying I agree with this thing. Like anytime they're trying to do something to intentionally hinder police officers from doing their job, I'm not a big fan of it. But what was the big problem? I'm not saying it's like, show me the part where it said you can't do your job anymore. And, I didn't thoroughly read through it. I skipped. It's a big article. I kind of tried to pick the highlight articles out and nobody had an answer. Nobody had an answer. And they're like, well, a lot of places are going to this in order to get consent. You need reasonable suspicion. Okay. Here's some advice for everybody listening to this. Why would you ask for consent without reasonable suspicion? So the game is you need to learn how to document reasonable suspicion. Good news. Email streetcoptraining@gmail.com. We have a RAS checklist for all law enforcement to have. You can review that. The only thing I don't like about that is when you add in this prerequisite of reasonable suspicion to even merely ask for consent, you're giving defense just an ability to try to challenge the reasonable suspicion, even within the scope or the time limit that you already originally had with the traffic stop. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I always advocate that. Number two, I just want to remind everybody that just because marijuana is getting legalized doesn't mean that everything else became legalized. They didn't say, that's it. There's no more laws. Like we still have a lot of crimes that are occurring that we need to be there for our society. And that's crimes like, rape, murder, kidnapping, homicide. I already said murder. So that's double there. Attempted murder, car thefts, carjacking, molestations, all these things, credit card fraud, identity fraud, elder fraud, theft, burglary, you name it, carjacking. We still got to go out and try to curtail some of this stuff. And people have asked, I had a friend of mine who's an old partner of mine. They said, you know, do you feel like police officers, you feel like the job is dead? I said, you know, honestly, in the mix of everything, I think it's quite the contrary. We're giving enough clarity to folks to understand what's going on. We have a lot of Generation Xers coming up to be in administration. And I think that they're not afraid to have the new discussion and talk about the status quo. And I got to tell you, I've seen more criminal interdiction units being created than disbanded. There's a lot of talk about it. The internet has really made it more understandable. And we have our groups on Facebook and other platforms of why it's important to do it. And, you know, I will sit down and have the conversation with anybody who wants to have it, who's not a complete waste of my time, right? On a political forum, on a administrative forum, a panel, whatever it may be, and have the discussion of why it's still very important and proper to be a proactive police officer. And all I'm going to do is play the episode we did in the interim between yours and I's last episode, where a gentleman was able to rescue a 9 and a 12-year-old who were being sold in the black market. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you when you want to hear about motivation. Just think about these people who just need you to show up. They're casualties of political war. And unfortunately, what the detriment to these political agendas is people's lives are being lost and there are being egregious crimes against society more than what they're claiming there are being committed. And we have to hold our head high and continue on and to lead the charge in the fight. And I always tell people, as long as cops are showing up, we'll be showing up. That's just the bottom line. I've said that 1,000 times. I'll say it again. I'll say till the day that I take my last breath. As long as cops are showing up, we'll be showing up. And people who think the craft is done and it's over, they're absolutely wrong. I think you're just jaded by your local agency, maybe your local county politics, sometimes at a state level. But, you know, even Minnesota, you know, we got a training coming up in Minnesota and they gave us continue ed credits, which we didn't think we were going to get because they have made this warrior style training thing. And at first they said, well, you guys are warrior style training. And we said, we're not. I mean, we're not telling you to strap on an M16 and put paint on your face. We're telling you how to not die. And we have spoken with a lot of agencies out there. Zach, we're going to sell out. We have a 400-person venue. That class is until August. We're over 100 in attendance already out there for my one-day course. And we've talked to a lot of folks out there. You're getting the liberal idealisms at the inner city of Minneapolis. You start leaving that county and going to other counties, you know, they're like, well, we've talked about California. California is not everybody just smoking crack on a corner. It's a big state. And in Southern California, where I think there's probably a little bit more of a right-wing feel, maybe more a little more conservative agenda. You know, they're not tolerating the nonsense that you're seeing. Those police departments are very proactive. They are curtailing crime to the best of their ability. So don't get confused, everybody, by reading these friggin' headlines enough. Be an independent thinker. Think for yourself and stop going along with the pack and listen to everybody else and join in the charge because it sounds like the fun thing to do. Nothing I hated more than just people complained all the fucking time. So anything else, Zach?
Well, you know, I just want to wrap up with the qualified immunity and kind of jumping off what you said there. You know, I mean, if you're looking for a good place to read about it, you know, don't read Fox News or CNN or, you know, if you want to learn about qualified immunity, probably a Law Review article is a really good way to learn what it is and how it operates and how it functions. You know, go to Google Scholar, Google qualified immunity, and it'll bring up a whole bunch of Law Review articles. These are articles written by law professors, law students, other academics in the legal field that talk about qualified immunity and different issues with it. There's a really good article. It's actually been cited numerous times by the Supreme Court by Professor Will Boddy called "Is Qualified Immunity Unlawful?" If you want to learn what it is and how it operates and why we have it, those are the places I would go for the information. Not the internet, not the internet in general. Not cable television, cable news. Learn for yourself. Read it for yourself and see what it is. you know, I'm not concerned about losing qualified immunity. I've given you my position on it. I don't think it should exist in the first place. Mm-hmm. The basis for it is not there. If Congress wanted it to exist, I think they would have put it in a statute.
Awesome. I have nothing else. We'll be back next week. Some real thoughtful content and candor. Usually we find something in the group. It's a hot topic issue. There's some stuff that's pending approval from our administrators that are some interesting conversations and topics. When I get to it, I'm going to have to answer it correctly. And then, you know, probably turn off the commenting because we know where that goes
quickly.
Yeah. It's terrifying. And it just reassures me why we have a training company that's so valuable and why we'll always be employed, because there is no shortage of morons. I'm not saying I have the knowledge and everything in the world, but I could promise you this. 15 years ago, not having the knowledge I have now, I would have not engaged on a social media platform and professed that I was some kind of expert on the law when I had absolutely no friggin' idea what I was talking about. And by the way, I'm not even professing I'm an expert now. We're just having a conversation of understanding we're at the next level of, Zach's really at a higher level, but we really gather and understand how the law is applied and how it's used, and to contribute to the nonsense without having a good knowledge base, you are not helping the cause. You just look like an idiot, you know? Right. So without further ado, that was this week's podcast with me and Zach Miller. His class, Constitutional Policing, can be found at streetcop.com. Tell your friends to follow the podcast. Give us a like on Apple and iTunes and Spotify and all that jazz. We're trying to provide as much value as we can on this platform, streetcop.com, like I said. Or if you're a police officer and you want to join our social media accounts, Facebook, we have a group there, Street Cop Training. And then on Instagram, we have a public Instagram page and a private Instagram page for law enforcement only. Guys, please just answer the questions or send your ID in so we can verify your status and ensure that we're having an open, confident, comfortable discussion without having somebody who has just an agenda to hurt cops joining in. Without further ado, Zach, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you next week.